So yesterday we opened up John of the Cross, and Ian Matthew begins by talking about the impact of God. We all experience it, but as he says, we can be very doubtful of it. Is it real? Is God real? Is God actually communicating with me? These kind of questions. And the beauty of John of the Cross is that he assures us that it is a real journey. And we watch his life. We can do it with any of the saints, but the one we're looking at is John. We're watching his life, which, of course, mirrors or invites us to watch Jesus' life. It was real for Jesus, real for John of the Cross. So it's real for us. And John encourages you and me to be brave, to dare the journey. We've got very good reasons for doing it, but to dare it, especially when it's dark, especially when it doesn't make sense, because ultimately sense is something we make with our limited ability. So even though we're in darkness, and we often are, believe it. Be in love with the one who is calling us. He went on, as we saw yesterday, we saw that John of the Cross experienced darkness. We focused on Toledo especially, that time in the cell being punished by his own community. And in that darkness during the winter months, he could hear the river right down below the monastery. It's one of the few Spanish words I seem to remember, and it's caudal. It was in flood. And massive sounds, and that reminded him of his longing for the Eucharist, because they wouldn't even give him the Eucharist. But the longing grew and grew and grew, and is expressed in another beautiful poem, which we won't be reading. So he experienced this darkness, and it's echoed in his poetry, and also in the commentaries that he tries to open up poetry to us lesser mortals who find it hard to handle the mystery of poetry. John surrendered to the impact in his life, and he encourages me and you to do the same. We can only move from where we are. And where we are, John keeps saying, it matters, but it doesn't ultimately matter. Where was the leper when Jesus met him? Where was Nicodemus when he came by night? The master of the law came by night to encounter Jesus and to ask, what do I do? Where was the woman at the well? Her life appears to have been in a total mess. Where was the man who'd for 38 years had been sitting there ill at the pool, either not really wanting to be healed — we don't find the answer to that question — or if he wanted to, he couldn't do it. So where was he? Where was Lazarus, for God's sake? Dead, cut off from life. None of this ultimately mattered, because we can meet Jesus where we are now, in the place we're at. And no place can keep us from this encounter, this impact of God in Jesus. John then went on, and I'll conclude my introduction here by talking about the gift. and it's nowhere more beautifully expressed than in the living flame. God is love, and God love means to give yourself, of course. So God gives himself to us. And the living flame is that flame of love which surrounds us, into which we're invited like the air, drawn into the flame. And Jesus wants to share with us his spirit, which means his communion with God, which means his prayer. And so, rather than imitating Christ, the danger of that expression is that we imitate him from the outside, which is not the Christian call. Our role is to not focus on ourselves. What we learn and we adapt to and we learn from and we, etc. We all know that. But the focus is on the flame, the invitation, the drawing of grace. So would you just listen again to the living flame of love, and then I'll open up the commentary. one of the lines of the spiritual canticle that I personally find perhaps the most beautiful line in it reads, excuse me, if only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I so long for, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. Ian Matthew refers that particularly to the gospel, the silvered over face of the word. Silver is precious, of course, and the words themselves are precious, but John knows that we need to penetrate below or be drawn into what is below the words to the word, to Jesus who's gazing upon us. And we know that's happening because inside us we've got the expectation of it. But it doesn't only apply, of course, to the gospel. The John of the Cross, if I understand him correctly, is the dogmas of the church, the doctrines that have been forged over 2,000 years. That however wise they might be, they are the word, and someone is looking at us through those words. I can't see why it wouldn't apply to canon law. I can't see why, of course, it does apply to nature. As we saw in the opening lecture, everything is a word of God. That doesn't mean, as we know, that what happens to us is God's will. That ignores the fact of sin and human folly and so on. The question in our life, if I'm right, is not, why is this happening to me? That question, it's an all right question. It's a question for science, for a psychologist perhaps, for a doctor. It's got a value, but it's not a religious question. The religious question is, where is God in what's happening to me? Where was God in what happened to Jesus on Calvary was the question. Why it was happening to Jesus, the Gospels answer that question, because Pilate was more interested in his career than the truth, because the high priest wouldn't budge, because the crowd were as fickle as crowds are always are. 100 reasons you can work them out why, but that's not where we see God. Where was God on Calvary? And he was revealing himself to his son dying in that dreadful way on the cross. So this prayer of John's is, if only on your silvered over face, silvered over by the beauty of nature, by the beauty of the gospel stories, by the beauty of church dogma, the Catholic catechism, all of that's there, but he wants you, that's Jesus, would suddenly form the eyes I long for, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. That was John's experience. It's ours too, but John doesn't want us to doubt it. The Gospels are portraits of Jesus. Jesus knew God in the love communion that sustained him and directed him. Being man, he knew God in faith, belief. He was in the love. He chose to believe. Belief is always a choice. And because he was faithful to that choice, he came to the experience, the communion for which he longed, day in, night in, and even on the cross. Jesus knew that real life consists in this communion with his Father. When he proclaimed, "I've come that you may live and live to the full," Jesus was giving expression to his longing to share with us this communion. I've just taken one passage from the Gospel there, which I'll read, and I remind you the eyes of Jesus in the icon. What's significant here? So we read the words, yes, or I'll read them for you, but it's the word in the words that is speaking to you and to me in this retreat. "Come to me, all you that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your soul." Teresa of Avila says, "Never say the Our Father without Jesus sitting beside you, praying with you, Our Father." Perhaps John's image here is even more beautiful. As we pray the Our Father, Jesus' eyes are looking at me, at you, in love, drawing us into that communion. Faith gives knowledge, the knowledge that can come only through love. It's a profound, more profound knowing than any other knowing we have. Recalling Jesus' words to the Samaritan woman, and the words were, "The water I'll give you will become for you a spring of water welling up to eternal life." It's recalling that that John of the Cross in stanza 12 of the Spiritual Canticle compares faith to a spring, and he says, "If only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I long for, which I bear sketched deep within my heart." In his commentary on this canticle, John states, "It seems that he is now always looking at the beloved." And later in stanza 32 of this canticle, "When you looked at me," he says, "your eyes imprinted in me your grace. So ardently did you love me." We don't organize grace, of course. Like the woman at the well, we drop our bucket in and do what we can. And like the people at Cana, we fill the water jars with water because that's all we can do. Or like the people at Lazarus' tomb, we untie, we roll back the stone. These are things we can do. But the grace is always a mystery and a gift. Words of John of the Cross in his canticle, "You looked with love upon me, and deep within your eyes you imprinted grace. This mercy set me free, held in your love's embrace, to lift my eyes adoring to your face." He wrote that in the Toledo prison, in the dark. You looked with love upon me, and deep within your eyes imprinted grace. This mercy set me free. Held in your love's embrace, to lift my eyes adoring to your face. Ian Matthews' comment is, it's been said that a person is enlightened not when they get an idea, but when someone looks at them. He has this image in his book of, and which you'd all experience somewhere in a different way, but of someone just sitting down reading quietly by a flowing river or whatever, and then you suddenly become aware that someone is looking at you. How we do that, I don't know, but there's a chemistry involved and we do it. And we look up and we see that someone's actually been looking at us for maybe 2 or 3 minutes. And we somehow sense it. And that's the image he has here. We are enlightened when someone looks at us. A person is enlightened when another person loves them. The eyes are windows onto the heart. They search the person out and have power to elicit life. One of my best memories of that is when 20 years ago or so, when I was very unwell, and I was here with a family on Father's Day, I think it was, at Neilson Park, you may know that, in Sydney. And my friend had just had his and his wife's 7th child, a tiny little baby. But I remember sitting away from the group, because that's where I wanted to be, and I watched the dad looking into the eyes of this little infant, and the little child was looking back. And I reckon it went on for 15 to 20 minutes. And I remember thinking at the time, what a gift that dad is giving his child. The child won't remember it in the thing we call our memory. It's too little for that. But the child will be remembering in every cell of her body still, 20-something years later. So that looking, that contemplative looking, is the art of life, isn't it? Whatever role we're in. You would have known the story of Michelangelo in the yard at Firenze, Florence, where he was doing his sculpting, and there was this piece of beautiful white Carrara marble that had broken from the mountain when they were cutting it. And no one knew what to do with it. It was so awkward in shape. And the story is that Michelangelo looked at it and kept looking at it probably for a year or something, excuse me, till he saw in the marble something that he wanted to reveal. It revealed itself to him. And so the artist then chipped away to reveal what we know as David, one of the masterpieces of sculpture. And what a lovely image that is for a parent, grandparent, priest, teacher, lover, to look contemplatively and not interfere. But when we see something in that contemplation, then to draw that out, because that's the mystery and the gift. Well, that's what he sees Jesus doing for us. The person is enlightened when another person loves them. The eyes are windows to the heart. They search the person out and have power to elicit love. And John of the Cross's words in Canticle stanza 33 are, God's gaze works 4 blessings in the soul. It cleanses her. It makes her beautiful. It enriches and enlightens her. That's his own comment on his poem. It cleanses, makes beautiful, enriches, and enlightens. Reflecting on that, Ian Matthews says, "The Son of God's face is smiling upon the world." The church is the body of Christ, of course, and we can be pretty foolish, I think. We can quickly look at what's wrong with the church, with people, with myself, with you. More easily, we seem to find it easy to blame others. But in any case, we can so focus on that that we forget that the body of Christ, we sinners, are being embraced by him as sinners, and graced to grow beyond our sin. But what a shame, not a tragedy, it would be if we took our attention from the eyes of Jesus and the Spirit of Jesus at the heart of the church and therefore of the world to be disheartened by our own or other people's sin. The Son of God's face is smiling upon the world. John of Cross's words, "In the first place, you should realize that if you are seeking God, much more is your beloved seeking you." Ian Matthew writes, "Where God is concerned, the problem lies in our desiring too little. And growing means expanding our expectations, or rather, making God's generosity, not our poverty, the measure of our expectations." In one of his sayings, which the monks wrote down, he writes, John of the Cross writes, "Enter within your heart. Work in the presence of your bridegroom, who's always present, loving you." The proper response to God's offer, and John of the Cross helps us to realize it's a real offer, it's not a dream thing, it's to trustingly believe in him, and that engages our desire, picks up our desire, which then draws us into the mystery. Two statements from John of the Cross, one from his ascent, Mount Carmel, and one from the Living Flame. "Desire with all your soul's desire to come to what in this life lies beyond your mind or the capacity of your heart." Desire with all your soul's desire to come to what in this life lies beyond your mind or the capacity of your heart. And again, John of the Cross, "Awaken us, my Lord, shed your light upon us, that we might recognize and come to love the blessings that you always hold out to us. And we shall realize that you stepped forward to show us your favor, that you have not forgotten us. Well, that's as best I can offer you, Ian Matthew's presentation of what the gift is that is being offered. He goes on then in part three to speak about space. Our job, our privileged task is to make space for the grace, for the gift. That's something we can do, something we must do, something we're graced to do, but something we needn't do. And since love can't push in, if we don't do it, love is continually offered for all eternity, but blocked by our distraction. We need to make the right kind of emptiness. The lives of the saints, which you may or may not have been brought up on, are full of examples of the wrong kind of emptiness. So we've got to be careful what hagiography we happen to read. I don't think it's a problem so much today, but it was when I was young. Saints did the most stupid things, and we were told that they were making room for God. Since they're saints, they've certainly learned since, but we need to learn too. Make space to receive God's gift, which is nothing less than God himself. John of the Cross speaks of climbing a mountain, the ascent of Mount Carmel. This requires energy and discipline, and a lot has to be left behind. He reminds us that the energy comes from God, that we're to climb only in response to and relying on God's grace. We don't make the trek. We don't supply the energy. Our thing is to listen and respond, and God will guide us up whatever track it might be. And it might be the road to Calvary, it might be the road to Transfiguration, it might be the road, whatever it is, it'll be a road, a path into the mystery. We don't climb alone. God's Spirit is with us. Ian Matthew writes, John steps out with vigour because the others, that's God's love, has wounded him. And there can be now only one thing to care about. John uses an image of allowing the flame to enter into and transform the log. He does it a couple of times. It's quite powerful, really. The log is damp, and when the flame comes in, there's a lot of sputtering and blackening and all that. But ultimately, the log is transformed into fire. It's just a beautiful, red, glowing parts of wood transformed now into the fire. He uses another image, which I touched on yesterday, of the flame which draws the oxygen into itself till the actual oxygen itself becomes the flame. And Ian Matthew writes, it's the flame that does the entering. The essential activity belongs not to us, but to the other, to the Spirit of the bridegroom. John also uses another image of unblocking a spring. The spring is from God, the spring of water welling up. God wants it to well up within us. But we have to cooperate by removing what is blocking the spring. And part of the retreat, of course, is perhaps we will be shown what in me is actually blocking the spring. What I need to do, what I need to leave behind in order to take the next step in love. In each of these, says in Matthew, the emphasis is not on our forging away. It's on getting out of the way. Maybe that's a bit strong when I hear myself saying it, but at least it's about trusting that the drawing is of our deepest self and that our deepest self is being realized in the way. The summit of the mountain is a huge space, and John of the Cross writes, on the mountain, nothing, nada. Nothing, because it holds the total presence. There can be no thing there, because God is there, utterly. It's a pretty Buddhist saying, I think, but there it is. The crucial question, says Ian Matthew, is not what must I achieve, but what stands in his way? What in me is blocking the desire, blocking the longing, blocking the attraction? The ascent of Mount Carmel is where John perhaps particularly describes these blockages. So let's have a look at them for a little while now. And these are all statements from Ian Matthew now. He proposes a way to break through the circle of our mediocrity. For John, created beauty is beautiful. People, art, nature. What concerns him is not so much the person or things being loved as the loving heart. That's what he's interested in, your loving heart. When desire is out of order, it increasingly causes fatigue, anxiety, confusion, a sense of guilt, and finally an inability to do anything about it. It's a picture of addiction, where the person's dependence is killing him or her. I was in Japan last year giving a retreat to our MSC there. It was quite a privilege, as you'd imagine. I came away, by the way, thinking how heroic their lives are. I scuttled back here to the reasonable comforts of my life, thinking, wow, how do they do it? Little tiny communities, miles from wherever. Anyway, I won't go into that. The point I wanted to say is I checked it with them, and they assure me it's true. The Japanese love saying, isogashi. I'm too busy. Sorry, I can't help you, I'm too busy. They love, apparently, they just love being busy, because it's apparently it impresses other people if you're busy. And so they say, isogashi. I'd love to, but I'm busy. Important, I suppose, but busy. The trouble is, and I've talked to Japanese about this and they haven't noticed it, It's a bit like English. We have words in English we use them all the time, but we've forgotten that every word comes out of an image. You can't see them now because they're blocked, but those things over there are called windows. I'm not sure you know why. You might, and I'll presume you do, but I'll still tell you. It comes from the word wind, of course. But the bit on the end, the OW on the end, is a bit tricky unless you know French, German, whatever. It comes from the word œil in French, or och in Languedoc. It's closer to the southern part of France, or German, whatever. It means the eye of the wind. Forget the glass. The window is where nature looks in and sees you playing Scrabble with your aging mother or whatever you're doing. That's a window. Quite nice, really. I like it in here. Isogashi has two characters in the kanji. One is the character for heart, but the second one is the character for destruction. So if I'm too busy, if you're too busy, your heart is being destroyed. So it's not what we love that is the matter. We can love everything, for God's sake. It's all worth loving. But it's the heart, if it's possessing, holding, busy about, then that's the problem. That's what's killing us, the addiction. Establish your freedom, says Ian Matthew, by saying no. No, I don't need this. I need you. What a beautiful thing it would be if I could say that, if you could say that. The Pope's trying to encourage us to say it. He even took a name of someone who actually did it, Francis. It's a bit scary in a way because we actually don't need much at all. We only need love. But there it is. Establish your freedom, he says. This is trying to see what the obstacles are. Say no. No, I don't need this. I need you. It is denying, says he in Matthew, not the thing or the person, but one's dependence on the thing or the person. It's clearing a space for genuine communion. Communion with, like Francis of Assisi, whole of creation was his. Mother, brother, son, sister, moon, etc. He enjoyed it all immensely because he saw it all as gift and he didn't grasp it with closed hands. John of the Cross has this image of a bird wanting to fly. He said, look, it doesn't matter if it's tied by a piece of string to the leg is tied by a piece of string to the tree. It can't fly like that, but it can't fly if it's got just a bit of silk either. We can't fly unless all attachments are cut. It's a big thing to say, but John says it. There are no such things as small attachments. The issue, says Ian Matthew, is affirming a greater love and transforming one's cravings for the sake of that love. So we have to believe that it's real, otherwise the whole journey's crazy. And thank God for John of the Cross and many like him who says, no, it's real, and we look at his life and see that it was. And we look at someone who learnt so much from him, and that's Thérèse of Lisieux. and Thérèse of Lisieux. As a child, I heard about the little flower and all this, and as I grew up, I became far too mature to bother with all that stuff, kind of thing. And when I went to Mount Carmel, I was there for 7 or 8 months helping with a tertianship for the Carmelites. So they had a library full of Thérèse's works, her letters, her plays, her poetry. I don't think it's much good as poetry, but anyhow, I was amazed at how what an intelligent, hard-headed young woman this Thérèse of Lisieux was. So I'd been sold a wrong image as a child. In any case, this is how she died, and you know it. It's in the little yellow book which the sisters all wrote when she died. She was dying of TB. It was a cold convent. They had no medication for it in those days, hence her very early death. But in that pain and that, this is how she died. She just, to the surprise of everyone, because she had no energy left, she sat up in bed, erect, gazed over and beyond the people surrounding her bed, had an absolutely beatific smile on her face, and was there for the length of a Salve Regina, I think it was, or a Creed, I can't remember which, quite a lot of time. And then she said, "I love you." And then fell back on the pillow and breathed her last breath. What's going on there? I mean, we kind of half know, but... she said, "I've never regretted giving myself to love." So here's a woman who gave herself to love and at the end of her life said she never regretted it. She believed, in other words, affirming a greater love and transcending one's cravings for the sake of that love, the one thing necessary. My own comments. Now, there's no freedom in having my eyes focused in on myself. My heart twisted back and curled over on itself. I must say no to giving in to this self-centered and self-focused movement and all that emerges from it. I must deny dependence on feelings. Dependence on others, on gratification. Notice he's not saying this wrong with feelings are wrong or others are wrong or gratification is wrong. It's the dependence on them that's the problem. God is offering himself to me. I must not allow myself to be absorbed in and distracted by anything that directs me away from opening my heart to God's Spirit. And of course, always we mean the Spirit revealed in Jesus, the communion between Jesus and his Father, the prayer, love communion of Jesus. That's the Spirit. My longing is to be a person in communion with the persons of the Trinity. This is love, not the false security of isolating myself in meeting my own more demanding and superficial needs. John of the Cross says in one of his sayings, "Say no to your desires and you will discover what your heart really desires." What makes you think your longings are God's longings? To live at the level of sense is to be hostage to one's own needs. To live at the level of spirit is to, quoting Ian Matthew, to live as a person among persons in fit for communion for the love which can hold the other and be held on open palms. And again, Teresa of Lisieux said, when I go to God, I want to go with open hands, holding everything but holding nothing, grasping nothing, possessing nothing. To live on the level of the Spirit is to make space for the gift of the other. Ian Matthew then focuses on Ascent, Book 1, Chapter 13, which is one of the most complicated for us who are trying to understand John of the Cross. And he opens it up, I think, quite beautifully for us. I hope I can do that a little bit now. And we'll conclude with the next couple of slides on this. Ian Matthew writes, essentially, the message here runs, choose the person of Christ. Get used to making him, not your feelings, your ultimate basis for action. We see Jesus doing this beautifully in relation to his Father, as you know, at the end of chapter 1 of Mark, having had a busy day, healing and so on. And then the next morning, they come to have more of the same from Jesus in Capernaum, and he's not there, so Peter and some of the others go out looking for Jesus, and they find him, and he's been in prayer all night. And we know what his prayer's about by what happens. They said to him, look, why are you here? Everybody's looking for you. Wouldn't it be lovely to be a parish priest somewhere where everyone in the parish was looking for you? For good reasons, I mean. Well, what a beautiful thing it would be to be a parent and have all your teenage kids and everybody else just hardly waiting for you to come home. That'd be a great feeling. Wouldn't it be beautiful to be a pastoral help in a parish where, there's an exciting... Well, of course, that's where we want to go. We want to be there. Jesus wanted to go back to Capernaum, for sure. Because everyone was looking for him there. But what did he do? He said, no, I must go on. Because that's why I'm sent. So somewhere at the depth of it was where God wanted him to be, as best he could discern it, that directed his path, not other people's desires or his own comfort in being in that place. So once again, Ian Matthew says, essentially the message runs, choose the person of Christ. Watch him doing his Father's will and let him live in you. Get used to making him, not your own feelings, your ultimate basis for action. Begin with a yes to interior imitation of Christ. I'm now living over there in the novitiate on my own, and 60 years ago, it's hard to believe, but it is. Yeah, 60 years ago, heavens. I was in the same building upstairs as a novice, along with six others. And one of the few books we were allowed to read was The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis. It may be your favourite book, and don't let what I say interfere with that. But it wasn't mine then, and I read it a few years ago, and I realised, of course, it wasn't, and it isn't now. In any case, I probably misunderstood it, but I thought I was supposed to imitate Christ. Sounds good. And, of course, I didn't make much of a job of it. How do you love like Jesus? How do you pray like Jesus? How do you be patient like Jesus? It's kind of beyond me, anyhow. So, and then I remember going down the seminary, and at the age of 18, or maybe 19 at the most, anyhow, I read this book by a German Jesuit called De Jager, and it's called One with Jesus. And he made the point, which I remember then experiencing as an enormous freedom, a lifting of a weight. He said, no, you don't imitate. The Christian way is not to imitate Jesus, it's to let Jesus live in you. And I remember experiencing that as something utterly different. So I don't have to be patient like him, I have to let him dwell in me and be patient in me. And that kind of grows a bit and you end up being patient, or rather, he in me is patient. I don't have to love like him, I have to let him love in me. Sounds good, doesn't it? It's a lot easier, by the way, too, of course. And I think it is what we're asked to do as disciples of Jesus. I live no longer, I said Paul. He didn't say, I'm like Jesus now. Jesus didn't say, I'm the vine, I want you to be like a vine, I'll show you how to do it. He said, I'm the vine, you're the branches, cling to me and you'll bring forth much fruit. He'll bring the fruit through you and me. So we begin with a yes to allow ourselves to be invited into Jesus' prayer and into his communion. The no we're to speak is an affirmation. It's not saying anything bad about anything, including ourselves. The no is affirming a greater love than this thing for or person I desire. A constant longing for Christ. We're being invited to look again at our activities, including their burdensome side. This is Ian Matthew again, and to commit ourselves to them afresh each day for God. It's simple. It transfers us to the level of spirit and opens a space for the gift, the living flame of love. The whole enterprise is a response, not an initiative. Here's John of the Cross in one of his sayings, writes, who can free himself from his meanness and limitations? If you do not lift him to yourself, my God, in purity of love, how will a person brought to birth and nurtured in a world of small horizons rise up to you, Lord, if you do not raise him by your hand, the hand that made him? You will not take from me, my God, what you once gave me in your only Son, Jesus Christ, in whom you gave me all I desire. So I shall rejoice. You will not delay if I do not fail to hope. And to conclude, I have to learn. You have to learn, says John of the Cross, to say, I don't need this, I need God. The yes I say to God is in the context of saying no to my separate self. Not to myself, but to my separate self. Only God can enable me to do this. But the spring will not force through the debris, nor the flame drag the log into its consuming embrace. In the final paragraph of John the Cross, Ascent to Mount Carmel, Book 1, he writes, in self-dispossession, the heart is at rest. It wants nothing, because it's grounded on Jesus, not on itself. It doesn't matter whether it feels elated or dejected.